I never forget the first moment when I walked into a cinema. I was hooked from there on.
Hello and welcome to part 2 of week 4 of the Scanon podcast. In this part, we look at the top 10 movies about movies.
Yeah, so we're going to move on to Jason's list.
Jason has brought a list with him. The guest list. Hoorah.
So this week, yeah, I went for the guest list, and I went for a top 10 movies about movies.
Ooh.
Which is tricky enough, actually, to kind of narrow down. I did a bit of research yesterday and today on it. I'm going to do it. It is in order of my preference, I guess, but on another day it could be interchangeable. One could be higher, so on, so forth. All right. So I'll see how many you've seen, and we'll have a little discussion on them.
Excellent. We're getting academic, see?
We'll see what. All right, number 10. I went for a documentary from the late 90s called American Movie.
This is one of those underrated, underseen gems.
Yes, it is.
To the extent I haven't seen it.
I saw it in college a couple of years ago. Mm. I got it on DVD. And if anybody doesn't know it, it's a documentary called a guy called Mark Borchardt. Mm. I think it's how you pronounce it. He tried to raise money for his movie called Coven, which is this horror movie. And it's in this kind of this world that he lives in. It's like a trailer parky. A lot of alcoholics, a lot of drug problems, a lot of odd relatives, strange people. But his love, and I mean his absolute love, his joy for filmmaking. And then he there's things happening and like really, really kind of moving things. Like he questions whether his life is a failure and stuff like that in it. And it's actually very moving, and he really, really wants to put something up there that he can be proud of on the screen. And he gets to, he's an uncle who lives in the trailer, and I think it's like $300,000 in the bank. It's really bizarre.
Wow.
And his uncle gives him like $50,000 to make, and he completes it. He gets a screening of his movie, but it's really, he wants to sell like 3,000 copies of it so he can make his epic, which he has a script for, which financiers kind of look at initially early on the movie and just kind of go, yeah, we'll have meetings, and he keep coming back and less people turned up, and it just pops out. But he kind of, it's heartwarming. It's very, very funny. And it's really kind of, it makes you fond of movies and why people make movies, the madness of it. Because there's no real money in it, particularly with these guys. Like,
no.
Because it's real low-budget stuff. But glorious, if you can get to see it. Glorious, glorious film.
It's a film that keeps cropping up on my radar, because I'm quite fond of movies about movies. And
yes,
this is one that people always say, it's fantastic. But trying to find it can be a little tricky time.
But it's only kind of a really good college film library. I got a copy of it to see it. That's the only place I've seen it. Because, yeah, I haven't seen it around very often.
Hmm.
But well worth a watch. Very much so.
American movie. Right.
Excellent.
Right, number 9, which a film I've seen a few times, but I'd seen, the last time I saw it was in the cinema. And on one of the IFI open days. It was one of those, you know, those great days where you spend all day. I love them.
Anyway. Another one soon, hopefully, IFI.
Yes, yes, I would agree. Assuming you're listening.
I hope so.
And that is Singing in the Rain.
Oh.
Yes.
And
yes.
It's just, what else there to be said?
Singing in the Rain is one of my top 10 films of all time.
Ooh,
I need to say no more.
That's incredible. I don't know if would I have it that high.
No.
I don't think I would, but I love it.
I absolutely love it. It's, if you're going to, if you go in and buy it, it's Prozac on a disc. There is no, I can think of few more joyful films.
When I'd seen on the big screen, it was the first time I'd seen it on the big screen, and it's the first time I'd seen it in years. So I'd forgotten, you know, you forget parts of it, like, you know, the famous kind of bit.
Singing in the Rain.
But so many odd little things in it, like that, you know, that sequence, the
the Broadway Ballet, the Broadway Melody.
That is
yes.
Very strange.
It's surreal.
It's a
piece of surrealism.
It is, and it's beautifully choreographed, beautifully done.
Yeah, but the colours, they're so luminous.
Yeah.
And you're seducing, you think it's going to be just another musical number. Gotta dance.
Yeah, yeah.
And, but off he goes, it's weird. And then Sid Charisse comes in.
Yes.
And you think, what the hell is this? The Kiss of the Spider Woman? What?
Yeah. And there's so much love of that kind of that weird point in film where silence becomes sound.
Yeah.
And I'm not a fan of jazz singing at all. Didn't like it. Found it to be important.
Absolutely
important, but as a film it doesn't really stand up.
It does.
But when you look at it, you can look at that era through this film's eyes, it actually makes it much more appealing and much more interesting as a film. And makes the era just, what an era to live in where sound became a thing. Like,
I still remember the first time I watched it, and I never watched it all completely until I was a teenager.
Yeah.
But when I did, when you see Gene Kelly and Donald O'Connor doing any of their musical numbers, like Moses supposes, that is just incredible. I mean, the dance moves, they're...
Yeah.
Even the songwriting, some of the words don't make sense, but they don't care. A moles is a moles, a rolls is a rolls, a toes is a toes. Whoop de doodle doodle Moses, and so on.
It's a glorious film. It's a glorious celebration of film in a film.
Yeah,
and there's really nothing more you need. It's just glorious. Actually, I really want to watch it again. It's like, look,
me too.
It's like,
me too.
I've checked it. It's 278th on my list.
How do you mean your list?
I keep a list on flickchart.com of what my favourite films are.
Next week we're going to go through Niall's top 300. So it's an extended Flickchart. Edition.
I'm more a letterboxed guy myself. But
this was pre-letterboxed, so.
You liked this before letterboxed? Wait, I've missed my point.
He's a film hipster. before letterboxed was killed, he was there.
That's me.
Having to worry, having to care.
Okay.
Sorry. Moving on from
me singing.
Number 8 for me is one of the film that I really have to watch again, and I remember loving it just looking through clips and stuff, but I need to see it again, and that's Shadow of the Vampire.
Yes,
it's
great film.
It's a one joke film, but
it's a great joke.
It's a good one. The idea that Max Schreck was a real vampire.
And it has the brilliant Willem Dafoe.
Willem Dafoe
is just
it is.
He brings something. He brings Willem Dafoe to it, I guess.
He does. He's almost... Like, when people think of that performance of Nosferatu, like, you think of Max Schreck in the original.
Yeah.
You think of Klaus Kinski in the remake.
The Herzog.
Yeah. Dafoe completely matches him for creepiness.
And it's an extraordinary hand to a time, isn't it, in terms of... You have him playing Max Schreck, playing Nosferatu, then you get the remake of Nosferatu... And then you go back to one of the great early films. And it's such a legacy almost of a character, and the time is brilliant.
And it really just shows you the power of that film.
Yeah.
Because the original Nosferatu, people might think, silent film.
Oh, it's terrific.
It's terrifying. Creepy.
It is. And I saw it a couple of years ago on big screen, and it's amazing.
Just any scene where you see the vampire in a long shot.
Yeah.
Jeez, it's the stuff of nightmares.
Even the speeding through, you know, the kind of cameras, or the speed of it's going quicker and quicker, and this car just flying through kind of forests and stuff. Really astoundingly atmospheric and really, really creepy.
Really, really.
I mean, the fact that this is being celebrated, even like you're looking at somebody playing Murnau on the big screen, which I find really interesting because I'm a huge fan. And I think there's a thing, I think even Sunrise is referenced in it to some degree. I think, if I remember correctly, Max Schreck is kind of creeping around the set.
Yeah.
He's looking at sunrise on the film.
It's
like you're touching on kind of Murnau's kind of sunrise. And it's just the things like that, little clever things.
It's a film that has to know cinema history, and it does.
Because, you have to get it right.
Yeah.
Because you're touching on something very specific.
Absolutely. That's directed by E. Elias Murridge.
Has he
discovered a lot of his opportunities a number of years ago. He made a shoddy little thriller called Suspect Zero with Aaron Eckhart and Carrie-Anne Moss.
Were to watch?
No.
Okay.
But before that, he made this experimental horror called Begotten. It's black and white, it's silent, but it has images that just sear on the brain. Narrative is minimal.
What?
Like the scene where you watch a god disembowel himself and people creeping across barren deserts. And it's...
This doesn't sound like audience-friendly family fare.
It doesn't, but it's chilling, chilling imagery. Even look up a trailer for it on YouTube. Begotten. It's clear Murridge is some kind of, I don't know, wackadoo visionary, but he clearly loves the era, and that is all...
That's the technical term for it.
No. And that's all there in Shadow of the Vampire.
Excellent.
Lovely homage
to the past. This next one is one that I'm a huge fan of. Again, I need to revisit. I've seen it, I'd say, about over a decade ago. In the Soup.
Alexander Rockwell.
That's a wonderful film.
I saw it once many years ago, so I desperately need to rewatch it.
My abiding memory of it is a scene quite early on after Sima Cassell meets Steve Buscemi, who plays, I think it's Adolfo, isn't it? Adolfo Rolo. Wonderfully named. Steve Buscemi has written a 500-page screenplay, a masterpiece of a screenplay, as he called it. And Seymour Cassell wants to invest in him. He wants to do art. He's a gangster, a kind of dull gangster. And he gets him to read the script. He's like, read the screenplay to me. And he sits back up in the sunlight. And it's beautifully shot, black and white. Absolutely beautifully shot, this. And he starts reading. And it's like, it stays on, I think it stays on Seymour Cassell. And he's like, stop reading. This is horrible. It's like, what page are you on? It's like, I think you're page 3 or something. He's like, he only started and he hates it. He actually hates it. It's just wonderfully done.
Yeah.
And it's just, there's so much great stuff. Ginger Mouche, I think, turns up in it as well.
Oh, I gotta see it now.
I need to see it again. But again, just looking at a couple of clips of it today, and it's like, I haven't seen this one in a long while.
It's another one that really never got much attention, I think.
Be very careful. Or you say this one?
Yeah.
Oh, it didn't. And not really talked of much anymore.
No, and I, again, it's a long time since I saw it, but it's quite great, funny,
and it's gorgeous to look at. I remember thinking that when I was watching the time, it's like, this is stunningly shot.
I'm struggling to think, did Rockwell ever do much since?
Well, I know he did one of the Four Rooms bits, didn't he, if I remember correctly, did he?
Yes, I think you're right. Him and Tarantino.
And Alison Anders and somebody else.
Yeah.
That was a real miss for.
It was.
God, I don't want to talk about that again. I feel a little
In the soup. Let's talk about
In the soup.
Yes.
Not to be confused with In the Loop, which is a marvellous comedy.
Oh, it is.
Yeah. Marvellous. Watch either.
Have an In the Double.
In the Soup.
Go.
And then In the Loop.
That's some sort. I'd
do that.
I'd get in that.
Then Under the Skin.
Yes. Very good, man. There's thematic links there. Very, very good.
Indeed.
Okay, on to next, which is the brilliant. Brilliant adaptation.
Yes.
Oh, yes. This is one where if you want your grey matter fiddled with, go with it. It's a
great Charlie Kaufman, who just gets all reflexive, tries to do an adaptation of Suzanne Orlean's book, The Orchid Thief, fails, writes about doing the adaptation, invents a twin brother, Donald Coughlin, played wonderfully by Nicolas Cage.
Both of them, yeah.
And it's just insanely brilliant.
Yeah.
And it's smart. The script is scalpel sharp about the art of writing screenplays, about how Hollywood gives us those Hollywood endings that make no sense to the rest of the film by doing exactly that. And it's just terrific. Brilliantly acted. Cage, I don't think, has ever been better in a lot of ways.
In many ways. It's up to... It's Dash and Leaving Las Vegas are his best.
He's just... He jumps into this. He grabs with both hands.
Yeah. And Badger.
And Badger, which is awesome.
Streep is in there as... Streep is great. Yeah, Streep.
Yeah.
Chris Cooper.
Brian Cox plays Sid Field, doesn't he? I think
Brian Cox, indeed. Yeah. And of course, it also has Tilda Swinton. If you're not sold by now,
should watch it for that reason.
Yes. Can I put out a controversial suggestion?
Yes.
Kaufman's best film.
Synodic New York.
Ooh, it's up there. I'll put it this way. It's better than Eternal Sunshine. Can we agree on that?
I would probably agree on that.
I don't agree on
that. Although I adore both, but I think it's there's more to it.
Yeah.
That's what I'd say.
I love both, but adaptation does have the edge for me, and I'd almost rank it up there with Synecdoche.
Yeah, it's a wonderful film. It's an absolutely wonderful film.
Yeah.
See it if you haven't. See it again if you have.
Yes.
Absolutely.
It's here.
I want to.
It's here in my DVD shelf. You can come around.
That's an open invitation.
We'll be reading those address at the end of the show. Okay, next we got Barton Fink.
Yes.
Ah.
Barton.
Now.
Nothing says somber mental writer going nuts more than John Turturro and a typewriter.
And that wig. Was it a wig? I hope it's a wig.
I would be surprised, actually. I think it might not be.
I think it could be right.
Yeah.
It's a glorious trip into a kind of really dark part of Hollywood in its own little way.
It's really, really dark when I think back on it.
It really is. It's genuinely dark. The hotel is a character in itself, and it's almost Lynchian, and it's...
You almost expect it to...
It's disgustingly, because the wallpaper keeps coming off. Remember the...
And you can find it put it back up.
And yeah, it's just brilliant. The glorious John Goodman. Michael Lerner is the studio head, who's just a delight.
He veers somewhere between being your friendly uncle and just
a
terrifying asshole.
Yeah, it's
basically it's your bank manager before you take out your mortgage and the guy immediately after you've taken out your mortgage.
Mr. Potter with half a conscience.
And it's great when it touches on that kind of, you know, the Broadway or playwright, the great serious playwright, reduced to writing. Was it Wallace Beery wrestling pictures? if I remember correctly. It's just great. It just that, like, how Hollywood just grinds those people down, like, yeah, you know, that have serious potential. Just write the next one.
It is very much a Coen Brothers film.
Yes, it is. Yeah.
So
for all the good,
yeah. So you need to be a fan in order to.
I mean, yeah. If you're not a fan of Coen Brothers, this is not going to change.
I'd say it's maybe a little too somber for anybody who isn't a Coen's fan to get into.
I adore it, but I can see why somebody wouldn't.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But that's just not to say that you shouldn't give it a try.
Oh, you definitely should.
If only to see a marvelous leading role by John Turturro, which is
glorious far John between, Goodman, which gets very biblical.
I mean, his lead roles are few and far between. His good roles.
Turturro, he should be in a lot more. Yeah. He's great.
And also, two of my favourite supporting actors ever, John Mahoney.
Where's my honey?
Where's my honey? And the ever wonderful Judy Davis.
Do we have to call him Mahoney and not Mahoney?
Yeah. I love Judy Davis.
Well, he calls it Mahoney, so I'm gonna
go with his. That he knows his own name.
Yeah. Yes, exactly.
We'll go with that.
And you, you momentarily distracted us from our Judy Davis worship.
Yeah.
She's amazing.
There's a sermon on that for another time.
That's it. There's a Judy Davis podcast special if you really wanted to go down that road.
Or just Judy. Just Judy.
Well,
so you could have one of Judy Davis, Judy Greer, Judy Garland. You know, Judy's in general. Very good.
We'll judge Judy.
Yes, we'll judge the Judys, exactly.
Indeed. I don't know where to go with this thing. we move on.
The next film, I guess.
The next film is the masterpiece of one Tim Burton, Ed Wood.
Yes!
Love it.
The only great film I would argue that he's ever made. Great.
Edward Scissorhands is close.
It's very good, but this, I think it's his masterpiece.
It is his best film, certainly.
It rescues the reputation of a filmmaker to some degree, even while celebrating his awfulness.
Let's not forget, Edward D. Wood Jr., he was a terrible, terrible, terrible filmmaker.
Yeah.
He had all the ambition of Orson Welles, just none of the talent.
Yeah.
That's the problem. But
it is very true.
But that's not to say that his efforts aren't worth commending. Yeah,
that's exactly it. And celebrating an outsider or somebody that doesn't have...
A trier.
Yes.
God loves a trier.
The Gary Neville of film. not the most talented, but God love me, never gave up.
I'd probably argue Death has never been better.
It's probably his most normal performance.
But he takes a character that could have been ripe for overdoing, and I think he plays it perfectly.
He nails the enthusiasm.
Yes.
Yeah, no, he is wonderful in that.
So beautifully shot.
The gorgeous cinematography there.
And the cast is just... It has, yeah, no, it's Martin Landau.
Martin Landau, his Oscar-winning performance as Bela Lugosi.
Yeah.
Sarah Jessica Parker not being annoying. Murray being camp as Christmas.
Yes.
Goodbye, penis. it's just another joy.
Yeah.
It is definitely Burton's best film. Not hard when you consider what he's making these days. But
it's a big fall, isn't it?
I mean, huge.
I think this is one of the best American films in the 90s, I would say.
Ooh, that's a strong declaration.
I don't know how high up we'd put it,
but it
gets into the conversation, I think.
And one other thing I found interesting about it has one of the most memorable scores from any Tim Burton film, and yet it's not done by his regular collaborator.
Maybe that's why.
Maybe so.
Yeah.
It's Howard Shore stepping in for Danny Elfman here. Just his use of the theremin. Yeah. Love it.
Best use of the theremin outside the original Star Trek team.
Yes. I'll give you that.
Hard to argue with that.
Ooh, I have it quite low. 533 for Ed Wood.
This is his flick chart list again.
Oh, okay.
Because I have Edward Scissorhands in my top 50. So.
Ooh. See? I
enjoy it. I really like it, but I don't think it comes close to Ed Wood's.
Another thing I should note about Ed Wood is that, people love it, but when it came out, critics loved it. It won 2 Oscars. Big financial flop.
Oh, it didn't make any money. And interestingly enough, thinking about Burton's subsequent career, it may well have turned him away from that kind of more dangerous territory than is kind of nonsense films, for want of a better phrase.
Yeah.
That's after the last few years.
But it's a pity because it has undergone such a reappraisal.
He should really be going back to making like $4 million, $5 million movies and just letting his imagination get out.
Then again, there's a lot of directors we can say that about.
Oh, that's a good apology.
But we'll start with Tim Burton. Then
that run was Burton made Batman 89, Scissorhands 90, So Beetlejuice 88, Batman 1990.
Beetlejuice glorious disaster.
Scissorhands 90. Then he made Batman Returns at 92, and then Ed Wood in 92.
That's a glorious
that
little
that is. Back in the day.
Oh, we had good films once. Yeah, anyway, we'll rest in peace, Tim Burton.
He's not dead.
He's not where his career is.
No, he just committed career suicide.
Yes, he did.
It's not.
And now slowly. Be careful now.
No,
this is going to turn.
We hope for a comeback.
This is going to turn into Eddie Izzard and Engelbert Humperdinck. Yeah. He's all right. No, I think he had a cold.
Right.
Next.
The brilliant, glorious Living in Oblivion.
Oh, Tom DeSillo.
Fantastic film.
I have not seen it.
I've seen it, I'd say, half a dozen times.
I've seen it once. And again, no more than in the soup. A long jury watch.
This does things with an independent film that I think are smashingly original. Mm-hmm. It's like this first two acts are essentially dream sequences. Which, for starters, straight off the bat, that's interesting.
Yeah.
And it has Buscemi again, who seems to prop up all
does.
Over this. All
he
over
does.
This. There's the kind independent film that he is.
No complaint.
No, not at all.
Steve Buscemi, Dermot Mulroney, and Peter Dinklage, I am in.
Dermot Mulroney plays, I think, the wolf who was the cinematographer who likes an eye patch. James LeGros, is it LeGros?
James LeGros.
He plays allegedly Brad Pitt from DeSillo's previous film.
Johnny Suede.
Johnny Suede, apparently. And he's an ego-driven ass in this.
I wouldn't doubt it.
I wouldn't doubt it either. But he's very funny in it. And he's like, he says to Buscemi at one point, you know, I don't know, he's like, doing this stupid film. I heard you're tight with Tarantino. So many lines. As Peter Dinklage, as a dwarf, complained about dwarfs and dream sequences, saying, I don't even dream of dwarfs in dreams. It doesn't happen. It has glorious bits. It has Catherine Keener, who's just...
Oh,
adorable.
Catherine Keener.
In everything. She's just great.
Now, after
this film is stunning.
After our Judy podcast, we have to do a Catherine Keener one.
Catherine Keener is amazing in everything. She's an actress that, if she's in the cast, I'll watch the film straight off the bat, regardless.
Yeah, Captain Phillips, she is completely and utterly redundant.
Yeah, that's because it's a big, silly idea.
Anyway.
But
moving on.
Living in Oblivion, if you haven't seen it, seriously, gotta see it.
Yeah.
It's just glorious.
More Buscemi. Always
more. Always more Buscemi. Right. Down to the last
except
two.
When he's working with Adam Sandler.
He's the best thing in The Wedding Singer.
Yes,
he's good.
I have a real soft spot for The Wedding Singer, really. Anyway,
I don't remember paying him. I don't know.
Right, number two, Sunset Boulevard.
Yes.
Okay, Mr. Murphy and Coyle, are we ready for a close up?
It has so much going on.
Yeah, no, it's smart.
So much going on.
Yeah,
as like from. The whole idea of Swanson playing Norma Desmond and watching Von Stroheim film in the film while he stands there watching her watch the film, it just gets down the rabbit hole of sadness and loss of careers of legends.
It's a tragedy of humongous
power. It is, and then it has the Buster Keaton and I can't think of the name. The three people play the card part. I have them written here. Buster Keaton, Anna Q. Wilson, and H.B. Warner.
H.B. Warner.
Dismissively called the Waxworks. and Buster Keaton apparently gets one line. He offers the word pass. It's harsh. It's a harsh film. And it's brilliant. And it's a framing device of a dead person in the pool, which has been seen countless times since in various references and lots of things.
Yeah,
and that brilliance of it, and the voiceovers are so witty. The weirdness of the world that is set in is just—I could watch it over and over. And it's Billy Wilder, who's just great. He's essentially God.
Yeah, incredibly sad film. I think
it is.
Anybody who is coming to it unprepared and hasn't seen it before, I think they could be quite shocked.
I had a bit of a Twitter argument with somebody who said that. He found Gloria Swanson's performance awful, and I said, "Do you know what she's doing there? Of playing that, still thinks she's in the limelight."
Yeah,
deranged,
delusional.
Exactly. Yeah. It's very hard to play bad unless you're very good.
And she
plays a hammy with that sadness and delusional in her eyes, and she's brilliant. I mean, absolutely brilliant.
It's heartbreaking.
It is. It's a heartbreaking film, and the older I get, and every time I see it, I get older. It gets more sad. And sad, and it's just, I love it.
Such is life, really.
Such is life, indeed. Anyway, I'll wait here and move on.
And any film that's still quoted to this day is...
Yeah, that last line is one of the greatest.
But it's that staring at the camera. It's terrifying. Ugh. It's absolutely terrifying.
It is.
I'm just in a maze where I got away with it.
Is it just me or a lot of these films quite scary as well?
Yeah, once you start poking back at Hollywood, there's that darkness underneath it. I think that's what happens a lot. Mm. When you start looking at
particularly if you look at something like LA Confidential. And
yes.
Yeah, I mean, LA is just, it's all corrupt, that's the point.
Well, interestingly enough, in terms of darkness and weirdness, my number one, or I've cheated a little bit, joint number one.
Oh.
Mulholland Drive, Inland Empire.
Oh, I am so delighted to hear you say that.
Nothing makes me sadder and weirded out more than Mulholland Drive's tone. It's like, for me, Mulholland Drive's a horror film, for starters.
It's and it's about really,
the decay
really
of Hollywood and the disturbing ways that it eats people up,
yeah,
and eats people alive, and basically just ends them in a lot of ways. It's terrifying.
Oh, no, it is.
It's a winky scene, still gives me the heart tremors.
It doesn't make, and yet that scene, it doesn't have to make sense. No, but it's there.
Everything about that film is just terrifying.
One of the things that scares me the most about it. As just it shows the kind of people that Hollywood attracts.
Yes.
Naomi Watts arrives in Hollywood as this perky young
innocent, the Oklahoma girl looking for the
business. Yeah, just got off the bus. Yeah, the cliche.
Yeah, yeah.
But she's so perky and so happy,
optimistic.
I don't think those kind of people can't really exist.
Well, she doesn't really exist that way either. In a way, like, it's just,
you see, that's the thing. If there's anybody who hasn't seen it. About two-thirds, three-quarters of the way through the film, something happens.
And you get to see the real...
The real, if you like. We'll say no more, but suffice it to say, Naomi Watts has never been better.
Nope.
It's an incredible performance.
It's an incredible performance, and what it does to those characters... And
psychologically.
And it is. At the end of it, I remember watching, the last time I watched it, it was just last year. And by the end of it, I couldn't really get off the couch. I felt really disturbed. More so than in the previous time I'd seen it. It just got under my skin.
But yes.
More so this time. And it's an astonishing film.
It is. Especially when you consider that film was basically just. Almost a hack job.
It was a
TV pilot that David Lynch had come up with.
And ABC rejected it.
They rejected it. He got some funding from Studio Canal to finish it as a film.
Yeah. And it should have been a disaster.
It was incredible. He got another Oscar nomination for Best Director. Should have won.
And I think it's an interesting companion piece to Inland Empire.
Inland Empire is...
Well, just before you move on to Inland Empire, I was just going to say that it is David Lynch showing De Palma how to do it.
Yeah.
Yes. That is a great...
You're absolutely right, because I'm not a huge fan of De Palma, because it's all show and no real...
No tell.
But that's what De Palma was trying to make that kind of film that was showing the dark and seedy side of Hollywood.
Oh, with
with psychological things, particularly with Black Dahlia.
Which is, as I said to you, a great book.
Yeah, great. Black Dahlia is a good
into a terrible film.
Oh,
takes away every bit of claw, every bit of darkness to it, and just has this surface sheen of nonsense. It's a dreadful film. Yeah, it is.
So, on to Inland Empire, which is one of the strangest films I've ever seen in my life.
I can't deny I would agree with that. Anybody who's listening, and if you haven't seen Inland Empire, I challenge you to do this. Start a stopwatch when you start watching it, and stop it as soon as you realise you can't follow the plot anymore.
Yeah.
My personal best is 57 minutes. It's 3 hours long. This is not a complaint, necessarily.
It's not.
But you really haven't seen anything like Inland Empire.
The first time I saw it when it came out, I remember watching it going, what in the Christ was that? And knowing that going in to watch it again, and I watched it pretty soon after watching Mulholland Drive, I really wanted to see them both fairly close to each other. So I watched it pretty soon after. Knowing that I didn't have to follow the plot this time, and I had a good idea of what was coming, even though it was a few years since I've seen it, makes the experience much more interesting. It makes it, I won't say it makes sense, but it doesn't not make sense. There's a circular weirdness to it that fits. that once you're not having the, it's kind of like watching a Shane Carruth film in the sense that if you stop following, like if you stop thinking about something as plot A to plot B to plot C, I don't even think of it that way.
Surrender.
And just let the thing flow around you. You'll find your own little path.
Let the visuals and let what's happening on screen. Yeah,
become apparent, and what's behind the film becomes more apparent. What's the subtext of it, the text of it becomes more apparent. I think if you let it go, the plot chasing.
There's no point in chasing a plot because the individual moments in and of themselves, you won't know what you're looking at sometimes, but or why it's there. But you'll be glad to.
David Lynch is far smarter than me. I can't outthink David Lynch. Nobody can. He's David Lynch, for God's sake. He's as close to God as we've got here.
Speaking of the great things about the film, Laura Dern.
She should have won everything for it. She is astonishing.
It is an incredibly committed performance.
Oh, it is. She's just brilliant.
Wow. Mind-blowing. As an actress who has won a role in a film, she's co-starring on Justin Theroux. It's been directed by Jeremy Irons.
Yeah.
And just as as they're preparing to film, things happen. Oh, it's Mulholland Drive again.
Yeah.
But the things that happen, they're even darker, they're even stranger.
And rabbits. Just...
Rabbits. And why are there rabbits in suits? And then, towards the end, the scene with the face.
Yes.
Oh my God. It's even more terrifying than Mulholland Drive, I think.
You may enjoy a film that's coming out soon called The Enemy.
Denis Villeneuve.
Yeah, Denis Villeneuve.
Jack Villeneuve's dad.
Connections again.
That was Giles Villeneuve.
Yeah, I know, it's been fun.
Denis Villeneuve's film, he filmed it before Prisoners, but it's only coming out.
I hope it's better than Prisoners.
So do I.
But basically, he's got Jake Gyllenhaal in it again. It's the story of a guy who discovers that one day when he's watching a film and there's a guy in the film, the actor in the film, is exactly the same. So not only does he look the same as him, he has the same accent. He is him.
So it's essentially the double, but not Richard Ayoade.
No, yeah, exactly. Yeah.
I hope it's better than that version.
Yeah, so
I get to see that, but I'm not a huge fan.
But Enemy has this sort of weird feel to it, and spiders turn up in it for no apparent reason whatsoever.
It sounds intriguing.
Yeah, it does.
You know the way that you could write a critical piece or a "this is my thoughts on Inland Empire," and in absolutely no way would it be the same as anyone else's.
That's very true.
The same thing is true of Enemy. No matter what you think of it, somebody else that has watched it will think something completely different.
But that's generally the sign of a good movie, in my opinion. Any ones I've missed that you would mention?
I'm going to go with one that's a little bit more lighthearted than some of the ones that are on this.
Sorry, also, they are a little grim.
It's also a good study of bad things happening to people in Hollywood as The Player.
Yes. Player, great choice.
It was on the outside of this list. I couldn't fit it in because I wanted to fit in the ones I fit in. But Player's great.
Yeah. You say that's lighthearted. My choice is actually one that's even more lighthearted. I think it's one of the most underrated comedies of the 90s. But it just makes me laugh like a loon every time. Get Shorty.
Oh, yes. I never thought of Get Shorty.
Yeah.
I loved it.
Gene Hackman as a hack director is genius. And it's Danny DeVito playing a more conceited version of himself.
Yeah, he's great. Yeah.
It's... incredibly funny, a bit broad and satire, but it doesn't matter.
They hit the target that they're supposed to hit.
Absolutely.
Whatever you do, do not watch the sequel.
Be cool.
It's horrible.
Yeah.
But yeah, guess you're already good call.
Really smart. Smarter than people give it credit for.
Also on the movies about movies team, I'm going to go with the heartbreaking documentary, Lost in La Mancha.
I had it on the list and took it out because I wanted to fit in what I fit in.
Yeah.
But it's great.
Yeah.
It's great.
Yeah. So this is
the mad world of the crazed world of Terry Gilliam making films.
Yeah, Terry Gilliam's attempt to make Don Quixote and just what went wrong with it. And
it's a terrific documentary, right? And it's fascinating insight into the process of particularly set budget filmmaking where something goes wrong, there's nothing you can
do. Well, that was the thing. I mean, his recent movie, The Zero Team, which came out 2 weeks ago, it was made for a budget of $8.5 million, and Terry says that he wanted to make it would need $20 to $30 million to tell it properly. And the stories he has of how they saved money on it are just brilliant.
Like I think Gilliam makes films that are problematic and not great a lot of the time, but the very idea that somebody like him should struggle for budgets It's kind of sad. It's sad. And then I just, and you have to prove your worth. Like Woody Allen's struggled for years with it, and now because he's had a couple of box office hits,
but it's,
there seems to be money.
It's the grounds in which they're playing is almost impossible to get financing in America, because you have to go beyond the pay.
They're not making those films.
Yeah, it's the but where studios lose the most money on is those movies that are in the 15 to 50 or 60 million dollar budget, and everywhere else they make money. So if you spend $200 million on a film, the hype alone is going to make sure that it gets back its cost. If you spend less than 10 million on a film, then the fact that it didn't cost that much means that you'll see a return, it's all economics. But it's the bit in the middle where it falls down. So a recent film that came out and it didn't even bother coming out to screens here, it came out in screens in the UK but they didn't show it here. It was Gary Oldman and Harrison Ford and Liam Hemsworth in Paranoia.
I heard about this. It's supposed to be a huge flop and a terrible film.
Yeah, so $35 million it cost, made $3.5 million back in the US. So you know,
but it's not because it's a terrible movie.
It is a dreadful.
Surely a good film made for that kind of money has a better chance. A good film has to make money. It must give you a better chance.
Another example of that was the Old Boy remake. Cost $30 million. I don't think it's made back $5 million yet. But again, not a great movie. But I would say that the only chance that any film that is in that cost bracket, unless it's angling for awards. Look at any lineup for Best Picture at the Oscars. They usually cost in that bracket.
But I would argue, though, something like, I don't know how much Dallas Buyers Club cost. I imagine it's relatively
quite low. It's very low.
Well,
it's about 13,
if not less.
I think they struggled with the budget on that one too.
They struggled with the budget makeup on that.
Yeah. But there's money to be made if you know how to market a film properly. If the film is good in the first place. I think there's a space there. There obviously isn't in terms of economics how they're looking at the moment, but I think there is.
To link it back to your list, there's Ed Wood. That would be a prime example of that.
But that's a great film.
It is a great film, but it would have cost within the bracket.
And didn't make a penny.
Exactly. Then you look at...
Sad, isn't it?
You look at Mulholland Drive. That was a lot of that was French money.
Yeah.
David Lynch, he gets a lot of
like Woody
overseas.
Allen.
Woody Allen too.
Yeah.
Go outside the States, basically, is the lesson here, I think, if you want to make those films work.
Yeah, that's a kind of a bum note to end my list on. But yeah, no, you're right. You're absolutely right.
Yeah, five for Dallas Buyers.
Five million.
Wow.
But they turned.
Because
I immediately made that here.
I heard a story on it. They wanted 8 million to make it, and a week before production started, they had McConaughey was on board, and the director was on board, and a week before they were still trying to figure out what way they were going to do the. They were going to do it, what way they were going to shoot it, and they stopped at 5 million, and they said, listen, we're going to do it this way, and they shot all of the scenes in such a manner that they could get as many of them out of the way in one day. So they tightened the shooting script, and they spent a couple of hundred quid on the makeup, so
it's miraculous in some ways, though, isn't it, that what you got out of it, like as an end product and a success story.
Yeah
so,
but it's sad to think that so many films are made that way.
It's actually kind of depressing. Depressed me a little bit.
But bring back the studio.
Oh, that's the bombshell. Yeah, indeed.
See, the problem is that
somewhere in the middle,
everywhere, at least with that system, most every film will get equal shares.
The middle ground is, because you usually spend at least half of the money again on marketing.
Yeah.
And so marketing those middle ground films, you're not spending enough to get the audience awareness that you need to get. And so unless it is a sleeper hit or an awards nominee, then you're going to struggle. It's why Gary Oldman, as I was saying last week, can't get the financing that he needs for his film.
Sad times.
We